Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry.
So here's a question. Do the gun control advocates live to fight another day? Did the White House really misread the Senate earlier this month? We'll tie up some loose ends and see if anyone really believes voters will go after incumbents on the gun issue in 2014. The president wants them to. We'll just see. We shall see if the new factory foreman in the manufacturing economy of the future might be customed programmed DNA. That's right. Can biology really make stuff like furniture and clothing and mountain bikes? That might be a little excessive, but can biology make stuff more efficiently and more safely than we biological humans? We'll talk about that later this hour. But we begin with a discussion of some of the risks in the traditional industrial economy, risks we see from Texas to Bangladesh, from a fertilizer factory to a garment factory, from an explosion that leveled part of the town of West Texas, killing 14 and injuring some 200 workers and residents who until this month believed they were quietly helping to put food on American tables, to a building collapse last week that has killed hundreds, trapped or injured thousands. People until this month were simply making garments sold around the world. There are already charges of negligence in the construction of that collapsed building in Bangladesh. More on that later this hour. But what of the risks here in the United States, where the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics says that workplace deaths are up slightly this year? Are there other fertilizer plants out there ready to go off? What other industrial processes pose a risk to people living nearby, whether through manufacturing plants or in the transport of hazardous chemicals you may know nothing about until an explosion lights up the sky just down the street? Jim Morris is a senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity who specializes in coverage of the environment and public health. Jim, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So I suspect for all of the things that you look at in the industrial supply chain and in plants and storage of equipment and chemicals around the country, when that West Texas explosion happened, something must have hit you in the gut a little bit. A map must have sort of lit up in your brain.
Yeah, I mean, this is just the latest in a series of disasters, obviously not all that high profile, but you know, there are about 200 experts call high consequence, industrial accidents in this country every year. Now, most don't rise to the level of the West explosion, but these things happen all the time. In fact, the same day that the West plant blew up, there was a fire at the ExxonMobil refinery in Beaumont, Texas, just about 300 miles to the southeast, injured 12 contract workers, seven were severely burned, just totally lost in the headlines.
Now, we understand the risks. I mean, I suppose we understand the risks of refineries. And to a certain extent, we understand that explosive chemicals are a byproduct or are the main product of a fertilizer plant. But what about other facilities, other things down the street that a chain link fence isn't really going to protect us from contamination if something should go really awry?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the people in West Texas gave this facility much thought. It certainly, you know, had been there for 50 years or so and had never had this sort of tragedy attached to it. So there are thousands of these facilities. And I think what this demonstrates is a regulatory failure on a number of levels, which I'd be happy to discuss.
Well, let's separate that into a couple of things. I mean, yes, dangerous facilities are supposed to be regulated, but there's also a question of scale. Agriculture has certainly scaled up in our era. Energy demand has scaled up. Do you think regulations have not kept track with the demands and pressures put on companies to produce in these higher demand times, or is the whole regulatory scheme just flawed to begin with?
Well, I think the regulatory scheme is flawed. Just a couple of things real quickly. You know, OSHA, for example, which obviously regulates workplace safety and had a role in this accident the week before last, only has 2,200 inspectors to cover every workplace in this country, which is, you know, absurdly low number, and had not been in this plant since 1985, according to the records. And then EPA also has a piece of this. There are people who say, for example, that the EPA already has the authority to regulate highly explosive or highly hazardous chemicals like ammonium nitrate, which was present at this plant in Texas, but has chosen not to do so.
And so what that says is that when we hear governments and lawmakers talking about don't get in the way of the entrepreneurs, don't get in the way of the of economic growth, one of the consequences of that is to turn the regulatory processes into a real token exercise where stickers are put on buildings, but inspectors maybe haven't seen what's been going on there for years.
That's right. And I think a really important point that many people don't realize is the Worker Safety Act in this country, which is the Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970, is just extraordinarily weak. It is still in this country only a misdemeanor to kill a worker, whereas it is a felony to commit any number of, you know, environmental or securities violations. And every time Democrats in Congress, including this year, have tried to strengthen that act, they've been shot down for the reasons you've already mentioned.
So if a worker, a disgruntled worker, shows up with a rifle and starts shooting people on the workplace, that person is guilty of premeditated murder, of course. But if in the course of the job workers die through negligence, that's just a misdemeanor, worst case scenario?
The worst case scenario is 6 months in jail for a misdemeanor, even if the employer, you know, just egregiously violated the law, knew about an obvious hazard.
Well, I guess the question really is, aside from fertilizer factories of the future, fertilizer exposure in factories of the future, we're certainly not equipped at this point to really think about the industrial dangers that are already out there, let alone the increased demand for some of the chemicals and things we've already talked about. Jim Morris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jim Morris is a senior reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. The effects of gun violence in America can be found in the workplace and far from the job site. But without the periodic spectacular explosion of fatalities, it's not talked about much. How much have you heard about the estimated 3,700 people who were killed by guns since the shootings in Newtown, Connecticut last December? That number comes from a crowdsourced collection of public data compiled by Slate. Well, this month, the U.S. Senate, after seeming to gain momentum, was unable to pass even the most humble new gun regulation.
You know, when Newtown happened, I met with these families and I spoke to the community and I said, something must be different right now. We're going to have to change.
President Obama marshaling emotion and a crowd of gun violence victims to deliver the message that the American people are with him on guns, and lawmakers who try to stop reform will pay at the ballot box in 2014. Maybe so. But it was a weary and exasperated Representative Carolyn McCarthy who told me last week that as a victim of gun violence herself, her husband was killed 20 years ago in a mass shooting on a Long Island commuter rail train, her son also shot and severely injured, she considers the fight for gun reform a very long game, and she's still in it.
I think time is going to be on our side. We know that the grassroots organizations are still going forward. We already spoke to Senator Reid's staff. They have briefed us, and he plans on bringing the bill back up. I think the American people are actually really, really shocked that they couldn't even pass common sense legislation on background checks. So it's an educational process. We've always said that the American people, the grassroots, your neighbors, everybody else like that, have to be able to call their senator, and then eventually, certainly, we're going to be taking it up in the House, but the Senate does have to go first. And you got to remember, we did win. As far as I'm concerned, these crazy rules that they have over in the Senate with 60 votes, I don't know anyone that considers a win when you can get 51 and over. That's a win.
And let's talk for a second about, you know, what might have happened from your perspective, Congresswoman. You can look at this as the events of Boston maybe took over everyone's focus, and this just slipped under the radar on some level, or you could describe it as a real misread on the part of the White House. I mean, they really played this wrong on some level by acting as though, oh, this is a big shocker. I mean, they must have understood they were going to get a fight here.
Oh, of course they understood. We were certainly in contact with the White House continuously through to be very honest with you, right from the beginning, everybody knew that's been in this battle. I've been in this battle for 20 years. I certainly never considered it to be easy. But I did think that because of Newtown and because of the thousands of people that we lose every year, I mean, on the first anniversary of Sandy Hook, we had over 3,000 people that had died. This is going on constantly. And for those that say that the bills that were up would have not saved anybody at the Newtown massacre, I say they're wrong. But I would also say that what we're trying to do is on a daily basis to be able to save lives. I spent my life as a nurse, and I certainly knew that I could never save every single patient. That didn't stop me from trying to save as many people as I could. And that's the same thing with reducing gun violence. And by the way, the NRA members, a very large amount of NRA members and gun owners and hunters, they're all legal, abiding citizens. And I don't think that they knew that everybody did not go through a background check. So I think that I believe that an awful lot of the majority of those senators probably didn't even read the bill, because if they did, they would have seen that it does not infringe upon anyone's Second Right Amendment. And all we're saying, we have to do a better job to be able to do background checks. We know the background checks work because we had over 100,000 last year that were denied a right to own a gun. These are people that you don't want to have a gun. And are we going to be able to stop every criminal from getting a gun? No. You know, I'm not naive about this, but I certainly do know that we can do a better job.
Finally, Congresswoman, the president suggested that there would be pain exacted at the ballot box in 2014 because of what happened in the U.S. Senate. Do you support the Democratic Party targeting individuals, either on the Democratic or Republican side, who voted against this bill in the 2014 election if they're up for re-election? And would you support super PAC money going specifically targeted at candidates who vote so-called the wrong way on gun control legislation?
Well, I look at it this way. Anybody that runs for office, we know that super PAC money comes in one way or the other to be against us. It's a part of each side, whether it's a Republican side or a Democratic side, to point out information about the member that they might be voting for. That's going to be, in my opinion, is fair game. That's the way, you know, that's politics. That's the way it is.
Congresswoman Carolyn McCarthy, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. Anytime.
Democratic Congresswoman Carolyn McCarthy represents New York's 4th District.
Find your city.
Later this hour, what defines your city?
Hi, this is Simon from Brooklyn, and I want to say that drinking 40-ounce beers on stoops and Park Slope is so Brooklyn.
My name is Fabiana. I'm calling from Miami, Florida. And walking into a store and not one person speaks English, that's so Miami.
Tell us what's so your city. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Still to come, America's growing wealth gap and how the recession only deepened the divide. That's coming up later here on The Takeaway. So what do you think now? Does the whole America equal opportunity land of the free idea really work today?
America is not a place where the chance of birth or circumstance should decide our destiny. And that's why we need to build new ladders of opportunity into the middle class for all who are willing to climb them.
Now, this comment got an applause in the State of the Union address this year, but consider what he said. America is not a place where chance of birth or circumstance should decide our destiny. Isn't America, by definition, the place where chance of birth and circumstance does not decide destiny? These new ladders of opportunity into the middle class Obama was talking about are not new. They would be, in fact, rebuilt ladders to correct a reality that America has lost its way as an equal opportunity economy. Well, the Urban Institute claims in a study that the recession has exposed the United States as an economy without equality of opportunity, a disparity that has so solidified in the past 5 years that only radical efforts to level the playing field will have any hope of succeeding. In studio with us now is Derek Hamilton, Associate Professor of Urban Policy and Economics at the New School right here in New York. Derek, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So the recession really has created some patterns or exposed some patterns that you say are nearly structural in the economy right now.
Yes, particularly on certain groups in the population. Certain subgroups are more vulnerable than others.
Let's talk about those groups.
Well, we know there are racial groups that are more vulnerable, and we can even extend beyond race and talk about class, but there seems to be persistently throughout our modern history and the history of the country in general that certain groups suffer more, and namely that black groups suffer more during times of economic downturns.
Now, it's been the case really for most of American history that when America began to track white unemployment and black unemployment and then the general unemployment rate, that black unemployment almost always exceeded white unemployment by a significant factor. What has this recession taught you that's new about that disparity?
Well, we can even go a step further and say that the gap has usually been 2-1. Which is, you know, why is it that it's 2-1 all the time? No matter what scenario we have, if it's times of prosperity and times of downturn, it literally the black rate has been twice as much as the white rate. So then when you have times of downturns and then the white rate goes to 7%, the black rate reaches depressionary levels of, you know, if it's 2-1, if the white rate is 8%, the black rate hovers around 16%. So you wonder, what is it structurally about unemployment that keeps that gap 2-1?
What does the picture show you if we're talking about Hispanics?
Well, Latinos are interesting because they're somewhat, you know, you have different time periods in which there are mass immigrations of Latinos. The Latino group is somewhat in an intermediary category, but they have high levels of unemployment that rivals the black rate as well.
So is it even appropriate to talk about a level playing field in the United States? Is it an absurdity? Are there things that we can do to address this structural problem outside of the, you know, constantly complaining about the wealth gap and the 99%?
Well, I'd say that the narrative of America is that if you work hard and play by the rules, you'll be fine.
Right.
But unfortunately, if that narrative is not there, it actually could have a detrimental effect with the narrative in that we don't even address it. It almost becomes where we can't even talk about race. We can't even talk about things like class. We get accused of cannibalization when that we're one country and all that. So having that narrative can be also problematic in that it removes options, public options, from addressing it. But unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be true that all groups have equal access. I mean, we can even look within certain categories. We can stratify by education. A recent report showed that blacks with some college had higher levels of unemployment than whites that had dropped out of high school.
And so the structural issue there is that unless you do something to compensate or to aggressively level the playing field at a certain moment in either the lives of these individuals or during their employment history, you have no chance of correcting this because it accumulates over time.
Yes.
So what would we do? What would we do? You talk about something called bonds for, you know, way beyond early childhood education.
Yeah. We need bold policies to address these bold inequities and structural boundaries. So in the issue of wealth, I would argue that what is a big determinant of wealth? Intergenerational transfers is the biggest determinant of wealth than, you know, virtually any other aspect of one's life. And when do people start to accumulate their wealth? When they reach their young adulthood. So you can have somebody who's a young adult and they can get some sort of endowment from some source, be it a loan, be it their parent, and then they use that endowment to start some sort of asset building endeavor that will mature over their life so that they can have a lifetime of wealth building. So we need some policy that can really level the playing field, not a giveaway, not a handout, but something that allows somebody a chip in the game so that when they become a young adulthood, they have some assets by which they can invest and take part in home ownership.
So a graduation from high school or college would result in some asset being given to you from the government that then you could invest or use to start a business or maybe to buy some real estate asset that's going to accumulate over time.
That's correct. My colleague William Darity and I, he goes by Sandy Darity, we've been talking about baby bonds, and that name was coined by the recently deceased African-American historian Manning Marable. We do personal conversations. We were describing child development account that actually Hillary Clinton had proposed when she was running. And not only Hillary Clinton, Republicans and Democrats alike have latched on to the idea of child development accounts. But we proposed something more bolder, something that would be larger in endowment and more progressive, so that if you're born into the most wealth-poor family, you would get the larger endowment that could mature when you become an adult and use towards some asset-enhancing endeavor. And the idea of it is not – you know, we want to encourage saving. We don't want to discourage savings. But the idea is to protect the children from any decision that their parent might make with regards to savings and also whatever wealth position that they're born in at birth, so that we truly can have a level playing field.
Let's, you know, it's a provocative idea, lots to think about for the rest of the day. Before we go, just a few seconds, would this be in addition to welfare programs, social programs that already exist, or would this replace some?
Frankly, I think if we have better resourced children, we can do away with subsistence programs, and it would lead to a reduction in a lot of the welfare spending that we're already making.
Derek Hamilton, professor of economics and urban policy at the New School here in New York City. What do you think about this idea, an endowment in young adulthood that would accumulate over time and protect you from bad decisions, either of your parents or of yourself? Call us at 877-8MY-TAKE. Post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Heavy machinery has been called in to begin the grim job of lifting heavy concrete away from the pile of wreckage of the Rana Plaza building in Dhaka, Bangladesh. More than 3,000 garment workers were believed to be inside. Hundreds are confirmed dead, many hundreds more missing. 2,000 survived the collapse of that building last week. With us on the line from Bangladesh is Anbar Hassan Itharajan, BBC Bangladesh correspondent. Anbar Hassan, thanks for joining us.
Hello there.
And I gather the rescue operation is finished. It's really all about just removing the debris.
Yes, I'm just outside this site of the collapsed building, and I can see the bulldozers, cranes, and earth movers have been working busily for the last few hours, removing the rubble from this building site. This building came crashing down on Wednesday morning. This contained a bank, a few clothing factories, and a shopping center. These rescue workers gave up hope of finding any more survivors past midnight, and soon after that, the authorities moved in this heavy machinery, and since morning, they have been breaking this building part by part and removing this rubble. And this incident has created a lot of anger here in this country, because more than 380 people have been killed so far and hundreds are still missing. As we speak, I can see below me on the road hundreds of people holding pictures of the relatives and friends who were working in this building earlier. They are still thought to be trapped inside this debris.
And what has this said about the garment industry in Bangladesh, or is this much more about the architecture of this specific building?
I think it should be both. And first and foremost, thousands of garments factory workers have been protesting in and around the capital, Dhaka, since this incident happened last week, demanding the arrest of the owner and also demanding better safety standards. One would think that since Bangladesh has emerged as one of the top exporters of ready-to-wear, low-cost clothing material, their factories also should be of world class. Definitely, there are many factories here. They are of international standards. And the factory owners say they have improved safety standards significantly in the last 10 or 15 years. But this is the third major incident in the last 6 months involving a clothing factory. Last November, a clothing factory outside the Dhaka caught fire, killing more than 110 people. I mean, we covered that event as well. So the repeated accidents in clothing factory means that there are some factories which are yet to meet the standards given by the international experts. And also, the government task force formed soon after the last November's incident also found out many of these factories, they do not meet safety standards. So that itself shows that the factory, the industry itself, has to go a long way. On the other hand, yes, indeed, there was some problem with this building's design. Last week, a day before it collapsed, cracks had appeared on this building, this particular building, raising concerns on the building safety. And what the survivors and eyewitness accounts and officials say, that the building owner ignored those warnings, and that's why he was taken into custody yesterday.
Before this growth, was the garment industry understood to be a dangerous profession in Bangladesh?
No. People here look at this industry in a very positive way. I know it exported $20 billion worth of ready-to-wear clothes, mostly to the European countries and the United States. You go to any high street in New York or in Washington, you'll find made in Bangladesh clothes. This has given opportunity for more than 3 million people, especially women from the rural areas. This has given lots of job opportunities for the people. So what is the balance? What many experts here would say is that now, 30 years on, now this industry is now going global. Now it is time for them to think about improving the safety standards here.
BBC Bangladesh correspondent Anbarasan Itharajan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and we often so admire some of the things going on at some of our takeaway stations where you can hear us on the radio. We so admire what they are doing sometimes that we just decide to rip it off. Take this celebration down at WLRN in South Florida, asking listeners to come up with some poems that end with the words, "That's so Miami."
This is Daniel Blair from Miami, and I'm calling to say, when the same radio station plays gospel in the morning and follows it with booty music, that's so Miami.
That is so Miami. And we can do that too, gospel to booty music. Here's another one from Toby. Fender bender accident, people shouting in three languages, that's so Miami. Join me now, Scott Cunningham. Scott, welcome.
Hi, John.
So this is great stuff, and I gather that this is the latest iteration of something you co-founded called Oh Miami, which is kind of a poetry slam meets civic booster idea.
That's right. We founded it in 2011 with the Knight Foundation with the mission of trying to reach every single person in Miami-Dade County with a poem during 1 month, during the month of April.
And what That's So Miami poems have you fallen in love with on this particular, round the gate?
Well, the one I've really fallen in love with, and I actually can't stop reading, is someone took Dylan Thomas's famous poem, Do Not Go Gently Into That Good Light.
Right.
And they turned it into a traffic poem. So the new title is Do Not Go Slowly Toward That Green Light.
Nice. Here's another traffic theme. Traffic affects the heart. Her soulmate might live 30 minutes down the turnpike, but a half hour can become an eternity, and so she only dates her own zip code. That's so Miami.
Yeah, that is so Miami.
There's a weather theme, too. Leave home with umbrella and shades. It's pouring rain. Oh, wait. It's sunshine again. That's so Miami.
And creative pronunciation of words is also very Miami.
And what do you hope is accomplished by every person in Miami reached with a poem?
Well, what I hope is that people, on the one hand, feel more connected to their city. We wanted to do a project that really emphasized place. There have been a lot of studies out recently that connection with place and arts and culture in your city is really important to being happy about where you live. And then on the other hand, we really believe that poetry is an art form that anyone can practice, that it's something that improves your life, that's fun. And so we try to promote this idea that everyone should participate, and it's, not just for experts.
Great thoughts there. And people from Miami have really taken this to heart. And now, how long have you lived in Miami, Scott?
I've been here since 2005.
All right. And you've lived other places in the United States, right?
I have, yeah.
And I said at the top of this segment that when stuff happens at stations that we love, we just rip it off, right?
I think that's a great idea.
So we were sending out to some of our listeners, okay, you do this and end it with That's So Your Hometown. Listen to this one that we got over the weekend. Gluten-free restaurant options and several great restaurants and bars that allow us to bring our dogs. That's so...
Oh, man.
Can you guess? Yes! You nailed it, dude. I'll give you one other one. That's fabulous. I saw a pickup truck with Larry the Cable Guy for President written in the dirt on the back window. Seriously, that's so... This one's hard.
Nashville?
Oh, no, Saginaw. Saginaw, ooh. Michigan. Okay. Yes, indeed. And I've been to Saginaw. That's actually... pretty dead on for Saginaw. Well, Scott, thanks so much. Do you have your own That's So Miami in your own life before we go?
Oh, man. Oh, no, not really. I've read probably close to 1,400 poems this month. I don't even know what poetry is anymore, John.
Read 1,400 poems this month with a really great tan. That's So Miami. Scott Cunningham, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jim.
Co-founder of O Miami. And send us your That's So Your Hometown. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Thanks to our good friends down at WLRN in South Florida. Remember your excitement the very first time a printer produced an elaborate document you had worked on? A book or a paper or a report with charts and illustrations. We don't think about printing much these days, but what if we had printer-like machines that could be instructed to make things using biology? Cells would go to work on some inputs we give them. They would carry out our instructions and produce something in the real world that we'd programmed. Exciting. Well, Professor Drew Endy and some students at Stanford and Berkeley are starting to think about biology in this way. Endy is the co-director of the International Open Facility Advancing Biotechnology. They call it BioFab. And he says getting cells to follow programs and make things is not just some hallucination he came up with from eating magic mushrooms.
The most amazing day I've had recently was a field trip down towards Monterey. I went to a farm called Far West Fungi. And they grow mushrooms on this farm. The input to the farm is sawdust. I was introduced to the farm by an artist out of San Francisco named Phil Ross. And Phil had been doing this incredible work where he's, practically speaking, growing furniture from sawdust. So what happens is you mix up a wood fungus, which normally degrades trees in the forest, with sawdust. And in a 72-hour period, the fungus will grow into the sawdust to make a solid object. And then you bake that to kill the fungus, and you can varnish it to finish it so it has a nice surface and so on and so forth. That structurally, it's incredibly strong. So if I had my druthers, I would love to be able to bring a little bit of engineering into wood fungi. If we could put a little bit of genetic data storage and computing and cell-cell communication, what that would let us do is complement what the art community can do now, which is shape how the fungus grows. We could complement that with bottom-up self-assembly doing microscopic pattern formation. And I'd now be able to go back to my house, and with the family, we'd be able to grow stuff that we wanted, tiny things, big things, the patio furniture, all from the yard waste, the garden clippings that right now we simply set out in the bin on the street and throw away.
That's Professor Drew Endy getting unnaturally excited about patio furniture over a principle that's much bigger than a lounge chair made out of mushrooms. BioFab is developing an open-source language for getting cells to custom construct proteins the way DNA makes life. It's an advance in biotech that goes beyond exotic lab work and literally uses printers to direct cells to construct all of the materials that can only be made biologically, but they can have the beauty of rainbows and the strength of titanium.
You know, genetic engineering was invented 40 years ago in part at Stanford and elsewhere in California, and we've actually outlawed genetic engineering in the laboratory. So our students don't use the tools of the 1970s to cut and paste or splice genes together. Instead, what we're using is DNA printers that are actually derived from inkjet printers. So if you think of an inkjet printer for printing a piece of paper, we can take that same technology and sputter out little droplets of chemicals containing DNA in solution, and that allows us to print a molecule of DNA from scratch. So our students now become designers of DNA, working on a computer as if they had a word processor, manipulating genetic functions in the abstract, and then we use software tools to compile that down to a sequence of bases, letters, A's, T's, C's, and G's. That gets shipped over the internet to a DNA printer, DNA synthesizer at a company. DNA gets compiled from scratch. Material comes back through FedEx or UPS, and the students are able to take that DNA and they return it into the cell and connect it up to the processes of the cell.
Is the difference between a centralized technology, as you've described it, and a distributed technology all about whether we approach biotech and synthesize DNA from a patent model where we patent everything and think of it all as intellectual property, or if we open source everything and think of it as completely public domain?
Those two topics are likely to be coupled. But there are ways to manage it. You know, I think it more has to do with what people, what we want to do and what we want to have responsibility for. You know, so would you like to live in a world where it might be the case that you could take ownership of what's baking in your bread machine at home if you could reprogram the yeast to make a number of other things, therapeutic molecules, what have you, for yourself or your family? Or would you like to have centralized manufacturing of all of the therapies? Could you imagine a future where a perfume company designs a biosynthesis pathway and that causes fragrances to be made genetically? Instead of shipping chemicals in a bottle that you slather on your skin, that company could upload the sequence information to something like iTunes, and you could download that sequence information, synthesize the DNA, and transform the microbial ecologies that live on your skin. You'd have a living fragrance, if you will. So I think the openness and the coupling to the centralization or not, that can be managed. What's unknown is what people will want, how people want to interact with biology and biotechnology. Is it something that we want to wall off and have it, you know, contained in very professional closed gardens, if you will? Or is this a technology of the people?
All right. So if BioFab becomes ubiquitous, and its track record for creating really useful stuff is second nature, I'm thinking if you could get ceramics involved here and some microbe that could work with ceramics, you guys could genetically code your own mountain bikes.
So think about the abalone. Think about the sponges. You know, there's sponges in the ocean that actually grow fiber optic cables. The abalone shell is an incredible material. So biology already couples the organic world to the inorganic world. And you know, one of the reasons as an engineer, I and others find biology compelling and why we work on these tools that practically have the aim of making it easier to engineer biology is we are optimistic that there's a chance to reinvent how our civilization makes things. You know, instead of firing up fossil fuels and other petro-based processes and trashing the environment when we manufacture all the stuff we need, could we partner better with biology to make stuff in an environmental friendly way? We're very far off from doing that for everything our civilization needs. We have no chance of doing that unless we make it easier to engineer biology and do that in a responsible way. But I think you're absolutely correct, right? The biological world doesn't make just living things. It makes inorganic things, and we can partner through those chemistries to make a number of objects. A mountain bike be a little bit of ways off, but something to dream about for sure.
Well, I'm certainly going to dream about a abalone shell wheelchair that I could have sometime in the future.
There you go. You should be dreaming big and trying to figure out what the right things to make are going to be.
Drew Endy, thanks so much.
John, thank you very much. Have a great day.
I certainly will. Drew Endy is co-director of the International Open Facility Advancing Biotechnology, BioFab, and assistant professor at Stanford University. Living with autism, well, that might be a lot of things to a lot of different people, but could it be a window on how the brain works? What other people do without thinking requires a reprogramming of an autistic brain. Syndromes like dyslexia are just an alternative way of perceiving visual stimuli. Autism, in some ways, is an alternative form of brain reality that only conflicts with the so-called normal society because our concepts of normal have become so rigid. These are among the provocative ideas of a new book. Think of it as a memoir of autism and what it has taught the author about her own brain. The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum, is the latest book from Temple Grandin. She was diagnosed with autism at age 3. Today, she's a professor of animal science at Colorado State University and is right here in New York in our studios. Temple, welcome.
It's wonderful to be here.
Congratulations on this. I think it takes a lot of self-knowledge and patience to be able to describe what's going on in your own brain, using your brain to describe your own brain. What has autism taught you about the brain?
Well, I've learned that the way I think is completely different. I used to think everybody thought in photorealistic pictures. Like if you say to me, think about a church steeple, I only see specific ones. I thought everybody thought that way. Then I started interviewing people about how they think. And in my book, The Autistic Brain, I've got a whole chapter in there on different thinking styles. You can have object visualizers like me that see photorealistic objects, or you can have more visual, spatial, in space, mathematical visualizers.
And so people who visualize in text, in the sort of traditional modes, are just viewing a certain domain of patterns. They're still visual, but in your case, you're much more broadly visual. You're seeing pictures, you're seeing all kinds of different patterns, and you're not confined to text.
Well, no, it's my mind kind of works like Google for images. It's also very associative. For example, if I'm in the Concourse B in Chicago, I see the glass-domed building, and I could get into a glass building category, and I'm seeing the old Crystal Palace at the State Fair. I'm seeing our greenhouse at Colorado State. Or I could get in an airport category, and then I start seeing all kinds of pictures of all the different airports I've been in.
Now, there's absolutely nothing wrong with your brain when it's doing that, but how does that kind of thinking lead you into some dead ends and can be something of a trap socially in that you have a difficulty communicating?
Well, in autism, there's problems. Some of the social circuits aren't hooked up, and I think that's actually a separate thing from the different kinds of thinking. I think a brain can either be more cognitive or a brain can be more social. And there's a wide range of things that are just variations of normal. You know, when does a geek or a nerd become mildly autistic? There's no black and white dividing line. And then, of course, when you get into very severe autism, you have somebody that's nonverbal, that may have epilepsy, they have very severe handicaps. That's definitely an abnormality. But there's a wide continuum of things that are just normal personality variation.
In 1947, which is when you were diagnosed officially, they came up with a word, autism, for you. There was no geek or even nerd back then, right?
No, there wasn't. And I was severely autistic as a young child. I had no speech until age 3.5 to 4. And so it was obvious something was wrong with me. But milder forms of autism, there's no speech delay, and they call that Asperger's. Well, now they're changing the diagnosis, and they're going to take Asperger's out and call it social communication disorder. It's still the same thing, because social communication is one of the problems in autism.
Do you think the word of what it is, autism, is less important than maybe being able to think differently about young children's minds so that you can identify what pathways they're inclined to go in, maybe different from the crowd?
We need to be emphasizing where the strengths are. And I've got a whole chapter in the autistic brain on jobs for different kinds of mind. My kind of mind's really good at industrial design. The more mathematical mind is good at engineering. But we need the two kinds of minds to work together. Let's look at the Fukushima nuclear power plant disaster. That was a visual thinking mistake. The mathematician didn't see that when you live next to the sea, it might be a really bad idea to put your emergency generators in a non-waterproof basement, because when they got flooded, the emergency pumps did not work.
Now, why does autism help you with something like industrial design? And let's remind people that you are a professor of animal science at Colorado State University, so there's a distance from industrial design to animal science.
Well, basically, I design equipment for handling cattle. And when I design a piece of equipment, I can actually test run it in my mind. And when I first started doing this career, I didn't know that other designers couldn't do this. I found most other designers, when they look at a blueprint, they can see the equipment still, but they can't run it in their mind. And then I got really interested in the whole thing about how different kinds of people think.
Now, how do you run a piece of equipment for cattle in your mind, different from just sort of seeing a picture of it?
Well, it's sort of like a 3D virtual reality simulation. You know, that's the big hot thing everybody's really excited about. I've been doing that in my mind forever. But the thing is, you can have uneven skills. I have problems in mathematics. And so what you need to do is take me and pair me with somebody mathematical. And when it comes to designing things, you're going to really have a good team. Because let's look at the mistakes made with a Dreamliner and this battery problem. I wouldn't have made that mistake either. When they did that mathematical risk analysis, they didn't think about the 3 cargo jets that burned up hauling computer batteries. You see, they just kept their mathematics inside the airplane, their own airplane.
I see. So in your view, it would have been clear that the heat problems on the Dreamliner would have required some fix beyond what you could come up with concocting the numbers to maintain
them. Well, that's
them.
Right. Yeah. And I wouldn't have put it inside a little flimsy metal box that was as thick as a file cabinet.
Let's talk a little bit about one of the fascinating later chapters in your book where you talk about intelligence testing and the various kinds of tests that you take, that you took for this book that test your visual acuity and visual sort of reasoning in addition to traditional reasoning, and how you surprisingly scored very, very high on certain aspects that aren't even tested for normal kids.
Well, I score very high on things where I can visualize. There's a thing called a grain test, and that's sort of like how many pixels of something you have per square inch. You know, what has a higher grain? bunch of grapes or a tennis racket. Well, I think about shoving the grapes through the strings, they're going to squish. So the tennis racket sort of got more units per, you know, area of surface. Now, the mathematical mind, it's sort of where you are in space. My kind of thinking are the brain circuits for what is something. There's circuits in the brain for what is something. There's also circuits in the brain for where is something. And that's where the mathematician excels. Also in the book, I've got a great chapter in the autistic brain on brain scans that were done with a new high-definition tensor imaging. And they found that my circuit in the brain for language output, for speak what I see, speak what I hear, had much, much smaller bandwidth than normal. And that's why I had language delay.
Do you love those pictures? You're so excited about finally seeing those scans of your brain, things you'd always imagine.
Well, I also really got interested in seeing the scan that showed that it had a huge circuit for visual thinking. And those brain scan pictures are in my book, The Autistic Brain.
And I suspect probably on a big poster blown up and framed in your living room.
That's right. I've got them.
Temple Grandin is an autism activist, doctor of animal science, professor at Colorado State University, and the best-selling author of her new book, hitting stores this week, is called The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this hour we've been asking you for the cultural phenomena that is so your city. We got this text from Florida. One time I saw a woman wearing three maple leaves as a costume denoting Eve on Halloween. That's so South Beach. From Michigan, when everyone thought it was a good idea to erect a RoboCop statue in the public place, that was definitely so Detroit. And from Northern New Jersey...
Hey, this is Seth from Hoboken, and one thing that really makes Hoboken Hoboken is when I hear one firefighter yell to another, "Hey, yo, I'm gonna go grab a slice from Benny's."
So Hoboken. And this one?
Hi, this is Meg, driving to work every day, listening to Takeaway and WLRN. That's so Miami.
Add yours, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tweet us your city's claim to fame. You can find us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.